I'm Robert and I'm an addict. My fellowship nickname is the Badger. I'll tell you the story because you're all laughing. You know, when I came to the fellowship, I had fairish hair and I had a grey streak. I had it from when I was 17 years of age. They call it the Malin streak. And so when I came to the fellowship, they called me the Badger, and now I'm all grey and I'm still called the Badger. So now you know the story. Okay, no, it's nice to be here. It's nice to be asked. Right, okay. Friday night. Where I come from, Friday night was party night. What the hell are we all doing here? Can I ask you, what are we doing here? Why are we in Narcotics Anonymous? I wish I had enough time to ask you for all your answers. I haven't got enough time. I can only tell you my own experience. I come to Narcotics Anonymous because I have made a decision to choose life. Okay? I come here for no other reason. I don't come here to get money. I don't come here to get laid. I don't come here to make friends. I don't come here to drink coffee. I don't come here for any other reason than one reason. I don't want to die. I don't want to die in the gutter. And that's why I come to Narcotics Anonymous. And each and every one of you needs to ask yourself that question, because I think it's a very relevant question. Why are you here? Okay. My journey's been a long journey. I grew up in the streets, Notting Hill. I was born in a street called Bowmore Road. It's still there. I drive past it, and the stumps are still on the wall from when I was a kid. You know, where we used to play cricket. You know, I grew up there. I moved into one of the first large high-rise council estates into Notting Hill it was 1958. Yeah, and I remember that feeling, because before that I was in a prefab. It was a nice little house, we had a nice little, everything was fine. Suddenly got moved into this great big council estate, and there were just debris on each side. You know, it was just debris. You know, it was just like bombed out houses. Everywhere you look was bombed out houses. Yeah, and that's you know, my history. And I remember then, age 5, looking up at those buildings thinking, what the hell am I doing here? You know, what am I doing here? I should be in the White House. I should be in Buckingham Palace. You know, what am I doing in this? Yeah, I almost swore, and I don't like swearing in the fellowship. But, you know, it's one of the things I try not to do. What am I doing here? And from that very, very early age, I connected with something that became part of my history, which was separateness, being different, being on my own, being separate, alone, isolated. You know, my first drug of choice was fantasy. Anyone know about fantasy? Right. Well, my life was hard. We didn't have any money. My father used to work 12 hours a day. My mother used to work 12 hours a day. I ate loads of bread and dripping, and it was hard. Really, really hard. You know? And basically, I discovered this wonderful drug which was called fantasy. I discovered the ability to be able to escape into my own mind, and I could be anyone I wanted to be. I could be Spartacus. I could be Geronimo. I could be Adolf Hitler. I could be anyone I wanted to be just by going into my own head. And it was the greatest gift ever, because it kept me sane. Kept me sane. That's what it did. It kept me sane. That escape. Probably my next drug of choice was probably food. I used to love bread and dripping, toasted on an open fire. I used to like the jelly bits with salt and pepper. Oh, it's delicious. And ginger nuts, I remember those. I could do a packet of ginger nuts when I was a kid, you know. Yeah, I remember that, so probably food. And then the third one that came about was the excitement. We lived on the streets, you know, in the railway sidings, and, you know, we ran across roofs, and, you know, we were always being chased, and, you know, and I got in touch with that adrenaline rush in my guts, you know, from being chased. You know, you're stuck on a 12-foot barbed wire fence, your Levi's have got caught, and there's someone trying to grab hold of your leg down. You certainly get in touch with something, I'll tell you that, yeah? Yeah, so I got in touch with excitement. That was my sort of third thing. Yeah, and, you know, and it was a different ethos in the sort of 50s and early 60s, you know. Basically, yeah, we started drinking really early, you know, really early. We were probably 9 years of age, and we used to go and buy flagons of cider, and we used to go into the burnt-out cars in Latimer Road, and we used to drink these flagons of cider, you know, and basically, you know, that's the way it was. You know, and I was very good at maths when I was a kid, and I used to go in the pub. It was the bank robber's pub. It was called the Bramley Arms in Latimer Road. And I used to go in this pub, and I used to mark up the darts board for the boys, you know. And they used to buy me halves of brown ale. Does brown ale exist anymore? I'm really intrigued to know. I have to go in the pub and ask for a brown ale and see if they give me one. I mean, they used to give you a brown ale. And I used to come out of this pub, the Bramley Arms, and there used to be a horse trough. You know, it used to be a horse trough outside. And I used to throw up by this horse trough. And the next night, I would be back in there again, doing exactly the same thing. Again, brought these half pints of brown ale by the boys to mark the board. Yeah, that was my story. And, age 12, what happened was I was asked to go and pick up my 96-year-old grandmother's prescription. And she had the best prescription in the world. Do you know what they were? Tunnels. A great big tub of tunnels, man. I walked into this chemist, and I looked at these green, red and green bombers. I thought, don't they look nice? And I just took out a handful, stuck them in my pocket. And in those days, the highlight of our working class existence was you would go to the Odeon Shepherd's Bush on a Saturday and watch a movie. If you had enough money, you would go to the Wimpy Bar afterwards. You know? I'm telling you all these things that no one knows about anymore. I'm sorry. But this is my history, not yours, yeah? And, and what I did, I was a member of a street gang, you know, in my day. You know, if you weren't a member of a street gang, you didn't survive for too long, man. It was dangerous times, man. You know, walking down the street was dangerous where I grew up. And, and I just handed out all these pills to my friends. They were my friends. And of course, you know, going across Shepherd's Bush Green was just hysterical. You know, we were bumping into trees, falling over and laughing. And, you know, and then, of course, we all got back to Henry Dickens. And then the fun really started. You know, the door just kept on going, you know, with people banging on the door going, why is Gary underneath the kitchen table asleep, you know? What have you done to my son? And I mean, I was 12 years of age. But suddenly I've been given a reputation, you know, and I was 12. Yeah. And it was the mod era. And there was no drug dealers, there was no crack houses. Those things just didn't exist. But what happened, what used to happen was that all the mothers would go to the doctors, and the doctors would just prescribe them all these various forms of amphetamines, blues, dexedrine, da-da-da. They'd just give them scripts. They were called Mother's Little Helpers, the Rolling Stones songs. And the mums would come back and pop these when they were a bit stressed and bang. And the kids just used to go into the kitchen cabinets and borrow all these things, and we just used to, you know, pop them on the streets, you know, and that's that was the start of my sort of using, you know, sort of 12. And then, you know, one day I came back, and a friend of mine came up to me, and he goes, we've got something really, really special. I said, yeah? He said, yeah, mephedrine. What? He went, mephedrine. You know it today as meth, or, you know, I don't know what you call that, but, you know, it's methamphetamine, you know. And in those days, remember all the stuff that I grew up using was all come from government registered factories. You know, it was in little bottles with government registered labels on. You know, it wasn't produced on the streets. You know, this was government produced drugs. And you know, I had my first fix, age 14, of methadrine, skin pop. And yeah, my world just changed the moment that needle went in my arm. You know, it was a bit like, prior to that, I had been a torso looking for my arms and legs. And the moment that needle went in my arm, I grew my arms and legs. I became whole. All my fear went, all my anxiety went. Everything disappeared. I became whole. I could exist. And, you know, it was a sort of, 1967. And, you know, it was mad, mad times. You know, and we would go to the West End and we would go to the clubs. You know, and we would rave and we would... And, I mean, you know, no one took drugs there. We used to walk down the streets in mohair suits and I'd just turn around and I'd go, yeah. And the guy would take out a 2 mil syringe with a couple of amps of methadrine in it and he'd stick it through my suit into my arm as we were walking along the road. No one knew anything about drug use, you know what I mean? No one knew anything about it. You know, so that was methadrine. A year or so later, they took methadrine off the market. Act of Parliament, bang, they withdrew it. It had gone through the working classes like us, wildfire. Every kid was taking it. And they just took it off the market. And that was the introduction. That was 1968, and that was the introduction of something that you all know about, the DDUs, the drug clinics. And all the doctors were stopped from prescribing drugs. All that had to be gone through the clinics, the introduction of methadone and all that crap that we all know about today. So that was 1968. And, you know, I was in there, man. And, you know, I mean, I never went to school, you know. I mean, I never went to school. I was thinking about it the other day. You know, they used to send people to take me to school. And I used to smoke 2 or 3 joints to go to school, you know. I mean, walking down the road, I would smoke a joint going to school. I just never went. I would go in, I would sign in. I went to Holland Park. You know, we would sign in and then I'd just go out the back door and we'd go to a house in Chelsea where someone's mother would go to work and we would just party. We would just party and it was wonderful. You know, I mean, the way I look at it in sort of retrospect now is... I had 10 years where it was just wonderful. You know, I had 10 years of using where I just had the best time ever. It was just brilliant, you know. And then one day it changed. One day it changed. Yeah, and, you know, basically, you know, I tried all the different routes and it's quite interesting what happens in our journey in life. You know, I mean, I was a member of a street gang. Next thing is, I made a decision, and I went to the chemist shop where I later picked up my injectable prescription, and I left all these amps of fisepton along the door at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I walked away. And what I did is, I walked away from my childhood. I walked away from all my friends, all my associates. I broke completely with my childhood, and I went. You know, I was a member. Yeah, you know, I was in Holland Park School. It's easy to do, and I just went for a new set of friends. You know, all the very attractive upper middle class girls who were flooding into Holland Park, and they loved me, and it was great. And I'd end up in £1 million houses in Chelsea, and you know everything was great. And I'd smoke dope and drop acid, and I did that for quite a while. And then one day it wasn't enough. And and I just went to the chemist and I brought a bowl of paregoric Alexei and I bought it up and, you know, it boils down to opium and I was shooting up again and that was it. And I suppose by that time I was 17. Decided to leave home. Decided to become a drug dealer. Met a few people, a few faces. Yeah, as you do. nice nice 6 foot tall, two Jamaican boy who always had drugs. Another guy, his favourite hobby was busting chemists. So yeah, I had the people who would supply me. And I sold drugs, you know, and I mean, I just sold drugs. And, you know, I'm sitting here in a Narcotics Anonymous room, and, I've already heard the earlier speaker say that they had no right to be alive. Trust me, I had no right to be alive whatsoever, you know. I watched so many people die. You know, it was almost like part of the scenery. You know, it didn't even faze me. It happened so often that someone would come up and go, so and so died, Joe, we put him in the bins last night. And you go, oh yeah, right. Okay, just so many people die around me. And you know, and I was supplying drugs, so some of those people I was directly responsible for. Yeah, so I had this very upmarket basement flat in Portland Square off the King's Road in Chelsea. I was supplying all the people that you read about in the papers. I had a nice little organisation. I mean, I became so arrogant that I used to walk into pubs, order a large gin and tonic and walk away from the bar. I didn't even carry money. I read that Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Byrne didn't carry money. I thought, well, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me, you know? And, I used to walk away and one of my guys would come to the bar and pay for the drink. I mean, you want to know about big heads? You want to know about big heads? Well, mine was Planet Earth, you know? I mean, I was just the way with the fairies. I was completely... I lost the plot completely. 100%, I lost the plot. And then things started happening. What happened was my girlfriend of those days is, she's 27 years clean, and she's the secretary of one of these meetings, until one day she decided she was an alcoholic, not an addict, and she went to the other fellowship, our mother fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous. But she's 27 years clean. She's still clean to this day. I do speak to her. And she had a brother, and her brother and his friend, Max, who's still here as well, they used to come around, and, you know, and I used to have... Everyone had a glass table in those days, and you used to have a big mirror on the glass table, and it just used to be filled with lines, and you have a bowl with three or four different types of hash. And that was the way it was. And they used to come around and I used to say, oh, you can have a line of Charlie. And these were kids, really. And of course, they would always go across to the brown on the other side, which was Chinese heroin. And I never really thought about it. I was so out of it, you know. And then one morning, I remember lying in this flat, looking at this magnolia tree that was in the garden. And just thinking, isn't life wonderful? Isn't life wonderful? And you know how life has a real habit of showing you how wonderful it is. 8 o'clock the next morning, the phone rang. It was Angie's mother, and she said, I can't wake Charlie up. And I jumped into my Mini Cooper S, and I drove across Battersea Bridge into the family home. And Charlie was lying there with a smile on his face, and he was dead. He was 17 years of age. So sort of reality dawned on me at that moment. And during that year, we lost six people. Angie and I together, we lost six different people, died. You know, it was just a year of death for us. It all came on top. You know, I mean, I won't go into the amounts of drugs I used to take, but, you know, just amazing amounts. You know, my drug dealer went back to Jamaica, left me with piles of drugs, actually. Didn't last very long, though. And, you know, then it all sort of changed and my world sort of started to implode. And all the things I thought I'd never do, I did. Yeah, and it just went on and went on and went on. We've all been there, we've all done it, you know, I mean, basically. And I saw some horrors, man. I saw some real, real horrors. And some funny things as well, but some real horrors. And none of it fazed me, you know, because I always had drugs. And it just carried on and carried on and carried on. And finally, what happened to me was in 1983, the girl I'd already spoken about, Angie, she took my virginity. Angie took my virginity. She's the girl who took my virginity. So there's an interesting one. And she contacted me. And she told me I was an addict and I should go to these meetings. And I said, yeah. And actually, I thought I was very susceptible to recovery and all that. But in the last time I spoke to her, she said, Robert, she said, I must have told you 10 or 12 times about recovery before you went to your first meeting. And I thought, you know, I thought that she had just told me and I'd gone to my first meeting and the message had been planted and everything. But it wasn't like that for me. She told me to go to my first meeting. And that was 1983. And I went to my first meeting and it was Hampstead Heroes. I think they just closed it recently. It was one of the original Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And it was huge. It was as big as this. You know, it was a really big meeting. And, you know, I went in there and, you know, I mean, by that time, I was totally socially unacceptable. I mean, people who know me inside the rooms will tell you that if you saw Robert walking towards you down the road, you didn't turn around, you turned around and you ran the other way. I was bad news, you know. I mean, I was completely crazy. And I went to this meeting and, yeah, and I was lovely as well. I mean, I had these huge hands. And I was incredibly well dressed. I had trousers with gouge burns on them, you know. Yeah, and I was just close, just short of 18 stone. Yeah, I was completely bloated because my liver was going out. And I went to these rooms, and yeah, and I remember Jackie's still clean in Brighton, I think, and she grabbed hold of my hand. She almost fainted just looking at my hand. But what they told me in that first meeting was, it's engraved on my soul. Keep coming back. That's what they told me. They said, just keep coming back. And that's all I've ever done, is I've just kept on coming back. And it took me a long, long time to actually, I would go to the meetings and, you know, Johnny H., who is the founder member of this fellowship, his name is Johnny Horton. Right, Johnny and Dudley are both accredited with it, but the person who founded this fellowship is Johnny Hall, and he was the one who started all the meeting. He was the one who was always here, and he is the one that we are all sitting here on this Friday night. Johnny Horton is the founder member of Narcotics Anonymous, and his nickname was Crowbar Johnny because he tried to murder someone with a crowbar. And, you know, these people befriended me and, you know, they gave me time and they gave me space and they would talk to me and they would take me to coffee bars. And I was crazy and I was stoned and, you know, I've never ever, in 25 years of coming to the fellowship, I've never seen one person get up and stash their drugs. Now, if anyone's ever seen anyone, I haven't, all right? I can only tell you, I've never seen anyone get up and stash their drugs. I used to go to the meetings, I used to rattle. I used to go and sit down and people used to get up and walk to the other side of the room. And I go to Johnny and people like Johnny and Jez and people like that. What's that about, Robert? They don't want to catch what you've got. That's what they would say to me. Don't want to catch what you've got, Robert, alright? Just keep coming back. Anyway, eventually, you know what I mean? there was no recovery, there was no help in those days. You know, I remember spending 9 hours on the phone trying to get help, and everyone just went, no, 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 no. And eventually I got in touch with a place which I call today Miracle Mansion. And there was one treatment centre in the whole of England. One. It was called Broadway Lodge. It was in Weston-super-Mare. And basically they put me on the waiting list, and I would have to ring them and ring them and ring them. And this particular day, they rang me up, and I remember her name. Her name was Helen, and she rang me up and she said, Robert, we got a place for you. And I went, that's really good, Helen. I said, but I've got a problem. She said, what's the problem, Robert? I said, it's my birthday tomorrow. And she just sighed. She just went in hysterics. This girl, woman, just went in hysterics. She said, if anyone else had said that, Robert, she said, they would be the bottom of the waiting list. She said, but because it's you, she said, you can come in on Monday. And so I went in there on the 28th of January, 1985. And yeah, it basically changed my life. You know, I mean, they stuck me in a room with an English lord who used to ask the nurse for a large scotch every night, and an Irish doctor. You know, and I mean, I'm a streetwise boy from Notting Hill. You know, and they stuck me in this room. You know, and yeah, it changed my life. And what happened there? A lot of people talk about different things in this rooms of recovery. And it's this thing that we hear about. It's called a spiritual awakening. And most people haven't got a clue what a spiritual awakening is. And I'm sorry, I'm going to be a bit arrogant now, right? Well, I'm going to tell you, right? It's a drastic shifting of your attitudes and your thinking. That is what a spiritual awakening is. And in that room, in that bedroom in Broadway Lodge, I experienced that. I felt the sun, probably for the first time in 10 years, on my back. I heard the birds sing, but again, probably for the first time in 10 years. Something changed in the way I related to the world, my world, and something happened. I had never worked, I had no qualifications, I had no education. I came out into the fellowship. Very, very different fellowships than the one we live in today. You know, we had wonderful meetings. We had early risers on a Saturday morning. Used to get 100, 120 people there, you know, on the King's Road, you know. You had the Red Cross Centre, you know, wonderful. You had the one in Kensington, in the hospital in Kensington, two meetings on a Friday night. Used to get 100 people there. You know, but there were very few meetings, and I just came out and I went to the meetings and I met up with someone, still cling to this day, Irish James. And we both had been in a detox centre called Ashdown Ward in Bexley Hospital. And we decided to start a meeting there. And we contacted them and they said, yeah, we'll have one. After we started the meeting, Johnny H came to me. He goes, have you heard of H&I? I said, pardon? He goes, it's called the Hospitals and Institutions. And we'd actually started this meeting in this bloody detox centre. And we didn't even know what H&I was. I mean, that gives you an idea. But we had the willingness. And that's what this program's about, the willingness to do something. And I did that. And I've done that for a long, long, long time. The man who these cufflinks were, his name was Johnny Lucas. And he was the first man to be diagnosed with AIDS inside Narcotics Anonymous. And Mary Abbott, it was a Mary Abbott's meeting. It used to be two meetings, a step meeting and an open meeting. It was big. And I remember being in St. Mary Abbott's on a Friday night. And he shared that he had just been diagnosed with HIV, AIDS-related syndrome. And I held hands with him to say the Serenity Prayer. And do you know what I did after I held hands with him? I went in the bathroom and I'm scrubbing my hands thinking I'm going to catch AIDS. You know, I mean, because we were ignorant about it. You know, we were ignorant about it. And John became, you know, a really dear friend of mine. And the characters, that's one of the things that saddens me about the fellowship today, is that we don't seem to have as many characters. In the old days, there was lots and lots of characters. You know, Peter Williams, you had Johnny Lucas, you had Crowbar Johnny. You know, there were lots and lots of different characters all over the place, you know, in the meetings. It gave it a sparkle, a vibe, a feel, you know, an emotion for it. Anyway, so I was in recovery, and I got a sponsor. He died with cancer. He was a counsellor at Clouds some years ago, a long time ago now. And I did my famous step five again, and he went and wanted to fix his BMW in the middle of my anger section of the step five. So to say I was close to murder would be the understatement of all times. So I went off to the other fellowship to find a sponsor. And I went to this meeting, you might know it, it's called Hines Street, lunchtime meeting. And I went to Hines Street, and I'm sitting in Hines Street, and I put my hand in my pocket, I pulled out a packet of Rothmans, stuck a Rothman in my mouth, and someone leant over from behind me and said, it's a no-smoking meeting. That was it. The fellowship had rejected me. I was about 18 months clean at the time. You know, the fellowship had rejected me. That's it. I can't even smoke a cigarette. And I walked out the meeting. I'm walking down the steps of this church. There's this little old man sitting there with a dog. And he stuck out his hand as I went past. And he went, I'm Andre. I said, I'm looking for a sponsor. Here's my number. And Andre came into my life, and you know, it just totally changed my life. Because we all hear these people, you hear their shares and all the rest of it, but let me give you the bad news. You can be the greatest NA speaker in the world, you can share beautifully and all the rest of it. It doesn't matter a diggle. Alright? It is all irrelevant. What is relevant about this program is the way you live your life. That's all it's about. It's the way you live your life. And Andre taught me that. He taught me that by action. I watched Andre and I saw how he lived, and I thought, for the first time in my life, there is a man that has something I want. And I followed him. And I try to live as Andre lives now. That's the way I do. And when Andre died, I was found by Bernard. And Bernard, you know, Bernard was one of the early people. He had the first manuscript. I wanted to look on the web and find out when the Narcotics Anonymous book was published. I think it's 82 or 83, I think it was published. But he had the first NA manuscript in England. He had the first NA manuscript in Bernard. And, you know, a little bit of history, you know. You know, Johnny and Dudley were going to AA. It's all Kensington, Chelsea, that sort of area. They're going to AA. And the people in AA were getting very peed off with them, hearing them sharing about drugs, because that's what they used to do. They used to share about drugs. So this guy called Sean O, he met up with this guy called Paulie. Now, Paulie is still clean to this day. I think he's 30 years clean. He's one of the founder members of the German Fellowship. And he spoke to Paulie, and Paulie said, I'm dating someone in the American forces. I'll get an NA starter pack. So he's given Sean this NA starter pack. And in those days, there used to be lots of meetings, AA meetings, in a place called Millman Street, which was a DOS house. And in those days, we had two meetings in a DOS house. We had Millman Street on a Thursday night, and we had Sunday, which was First and Life, which was in Bridge House in Clarendon Road in Notting Hill. So we used to have two meetings in DOS houses. And so Sean has basically got his starter pack, spoken to all the people he believes are addicts, done a Thursday, told about a Thursday meeting, and basically given them the literature, and they started Narcotics Anonymous. He's known as the silent founder member of Narcotics Anonymous. Right. Okay. I've been asked to stop, but I want to say a couple of things. One thing I want to say Every one of us in this room is one of God's kids. Now, I don't call it God anymore. I've changed my tack. I now refer to it as the universal mind. Because I am part of the spirit, the life force that drives every living creature in this universe. I am part of it 100%. And I don't believe in being different and special. If I'm part of it, so are you. You are part of the life force. So start believing it and start expecting better things. Please. Yeah? Start expecting. Alright. It's been nice to share. When a man or woman comes to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, the heavens fall silent and God listens, because the dignity of a human being is about to be restored. Thank you.